All right, welcome back. I'm Tarek. I'm an addict and alcoholic. And we're going to start off by Brandon addressing a question that we had in the break.
All right. I'm Brandon. I'm an alcoholic. So the difference between recovered and recovering. Somebody asked the question at the break and wanted to know kind of what the difference between the two of them was. And I'm a sports guy, and this analogy is lost on a lot of people, but it captures others. So a couple years ago, there's this guy named Adrian Peterson. He's a running back for the Minnesota Vikings. He, in one of the first couple games of the season, he blew out his ACL, the major ligament that attaches the lower part of the leg to the upper part of the leg. No big deal, right? Used to be a career-ending injury. They now have a way to surgically repair it. So Adrian Peterson goes out, and he has surgery, and then he starts the recovery process, which includes probably a regimen of drugs, weightlifting, physical therapy, things like that. During that process, his knee is recovering, trying to reach a state that he can then go out and function as a NFL running back. So during that entire time where his knee's getting better, he is recovering. Now, the next year, he comes out, almost breaks the NFL single season rushing record, and wins the NFL MVP. His knee during that next year was recovered. It had reached a state of complete wholeness to where he could then go out and perform at the same level, if not a higher level, than he had been performing before. We as alcoholics and addicts, when we first come in and we're first starting to go through the steps, we are recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then they just throw the spiritual malady in on top of it. Once we have gone through the steps, and once we have reached a place where we are no longer constantly obsessing, I'm not talking about thinking about, not the random thought. I'm talking about, like, swimming in the thought of using or drinking. We no longer are a slave to the mental obsession at that point. When we are dry or clean for a period of time and the drugs and alcohol get out of our system, the allergy is no longer triggered. We no longer have a physical craving to the drugs or alcohol. Seemingly, we've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. In that state, I am well. Now, a lot of people get hung up on this because they say, I can always go back out and drink. Yes, I can blow the same knee out that I just got back to a recovered state. I can blow the other knee out, and then I'll have to go back through the recovery process. I can have various periods where I go and relapse and have to come back. I am recovering during those periods of time. But once I am no longer obsessing, and I no longer have the craving, I am in a recovered state. And I'm only taking that out of the book, which had the combined experience of the first 100 people that had stayed sober for the longest period that has been documented. And they took that experience and wrote a book on it. And that they say I'm recovered. I believe I'm recovered. Does that answer the question to... And again, guys, come up to us in between sessions and ask us questions because we're going to miss some stuff. And if there's some things that we didn't cover that we need to cover, then we'll go through that. I wanted to read this real quick because I get a lot of people that will throw stones at me if I say I'm recovered because that they'll tell me that if I say I'm recovered, then I think I'm done. If I say I'm recovered, I'm afraid that I'm going to stop doing this. So There's a sentence on page 20. In the first full paragraph, it says, "Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body." The expert opinion to the contrary may be other members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. And this is the sentence that I like to go to when they ask me why I say I'm recovered, because it says right there, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered. I don't like to get into this argument much, but generally it is my experience that when a person says that they are recovering, they probably are. If a person says that they're recovered, they probably are. If you believe that you're still sick and you're going to stay sick for the rest of your life, you're probably going to stay sick and be sick for the rest of your life. If you believe that you have a chance to get over this disease and not act out the way that you were, then you probably do. There are too many people that hide behind their alcoholism and drug addiction as a crutch. I was an asshole to a bunch of people in traffic, but what do you expect? I'm an alcoholic. Oh, you were drunk today. No. Well, then why are you blaming it on your alcoholism? You were a jerk in traffic today because you're a jerk. It has nothing to do, unless you're actively drinking or actively using, has nothing to do with your alcoholism. You may have that spiritual condition going on, but that is not the reason that you're acting the way that you are. You're acting the way that you are because that's who you are.
Thanks, B. All right, so I'm going to cover some portions of the doctor's opinion. But if you're on, oh, page, I can't see my pages anymore. XXIV or XXV. It's XXV. I always give them a specific instruction before we're going to cover this. I ask them to read the doctor's opinion. I want them to separate drugs and alcohol, and then every statement that's possible, just ask yourself, did this happen to you in your experience? So let's personalize the book. You know, in our circles, we write, "Do I believe in the book?" Sometimes that, "Do I believe this statement describes me?" So we want to personalize the book, but I separate drugs and alcohol. And now the doctor's opinion is interesting. Yes, it's about the physical craving, but he touches on this idea that if our ideals are grounded in a power greater than ourselves, that we can recreate our lives. I think that's the most powerful sentence in the doctor's opinion. But the doctor's opinion, his opinion is about our abnormal physical reactions once we put drugs and alcohol in our bodies. In addition to that, he'll touch on the internal condition the doctor describes it as restless, irritable, and discontent. He also talks about the need to have a psychic change. Those are all very important things to talk about when you're taking someone through this chapter. So the main question to put in your book, if you're interested, is, what happens to me after I put drugs and alcohol in my body? That's the main consideration we're working with. If you go to page XXVI, I don't know about you guys, but once I was reached the my experience with drugs and alcohol progressed to the point where I was having a lot of consequences and I was ending up in a lot of places that I didn't want to be in, and I was doing things to the people that cared about me the most and that I cared about, I didn't understand it. So I remember hearing this word, moral compass, and I thought I had a broken moral compass and that I was a piece of shit. And I walked around with a ton of guilt and shame around all the things and all the places I ended up when I was on a spree. And so I was going through the book, and it says, the doctor's theory that I have an allergy or an abnormal reaction to alcohol and many drugs interests me. As layman, the doctor's opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers and drug users, we can say that his explanation about the allergy makes good sense. And this is the most important part. It explains many things for which I could not account for. Why did I show up intoxicated to family functions when I said I wouldn't? Why did I miss all those important engagements? Why did I spend other people's money? I can go on with the list. Why did I do these things? I'm a piece of shit, right? I have a broken moral compass. Once I really understood this concept by looking into my experience and seeing how little choice I had with what unfolded after I started using and or drinking, it accounted. I finally knew why those events took place. I won't say immediately, but quickly the guilt and the regret and the shame and remorse left me. And it left me even more when I got to page 24 and saw I didn't have a choice before the drugs and alcohol were in my body. But missing all the important engagements because I picked up a drink or a drug a few hours or a few days before the important engagement, I finally saw why I missed my family functions. It was important to me because I had a lot of guilt around not being where I said I was going to be. All right, so you can't go making amends and explain the loss of control with this concept to someone you're making amends to. No, it's not the concept. I'm going to tell you all an experience, and most of you know the experience that just took place in the past 48 hours. So this individual relapses, overdoses. I'm driving him after he's left the hospital, and I hear the words, "I can't believe I keep doing this." The way he said it implied to me that he thinks he made a choice to do it again. Therefore, it just sends that vicious cycle into guilt, shame, and remorse over and over and over, telling me the person has not understood this in the book. I watch fathers in recovery who cannot stay clean and sober. I mean, I've watched it over and over. I can't believe I'm choosing this over my kids. I can't believe I'm choosing this over my kids. Misunderstood the whole first step, right? If you look at this, it explains why you keep doing this, why you go missing for 5-6 days at a time, why you disappear for 2 weeks. This is it, right? This helps the addict get free of guilt, shame, and remorse. We cannot take this out into the real world and use it as an excuse. Get clear on that. So this is a paragraph that I spend some time with. Then the next paragraph I want to talk about is on the next page. And this paragraph, when I finally looked at it from the perspective I'm describing tonight, whereas I'm using it to reflect on my personal experience, not the experience of the 100 people that put the book together. I'm looking at it as if it's a mirror and it's looking at me. So we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on cocaine on me is a manifestation of an allergy. So do I believe I have a weird reaction when it comes to whiskey and cocaine? Absolutely.
We're on page XXVIII, 28.
This phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker or perhaps the recreational drug user. Am I an allergic type that can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, or drugs? I'm getting to a point where I don't believe every sentence in the big book anymore. I've had 5 surgeries in the past 3 years. I safely used opiates every single time. Okay? Is this Tarek giving you a green light to go investigate if you... You know, because there's a direct correlation between my spiritual condition and being able to navigate through that experience.
There's a certain level of accountability with how many people are you accountable with around when you're taking those pills?
At least 20. Because I send a text out to every man in my network that has spiritual consent with me.
Look, I just tweaked my knee. I have to go back on for a couple of days. Just want you guys to know. That these are the text messages. So fit spiritual condition is not just this internal, I think I'm spiritually fit. It's he takes it outside of himself. And that's why he's capable of giving on opiates.
Can I ever safely use alcohol in any form at all? I've eaten a lot of food that's cooked in alcohol over the years. Did I turn into a werewolf and immediately go on a spree? No. So the sentence is not true for me. That's just been my personal experience. I'm no longer a guy that says every single sentence in the big book has to be true in my experience. It just has, some have proved not true. Again, Tarek is not giving you a green light to go try these things. I don't know. But I'm sharing with you my own personal experience with this paragraph. But here's the most important part, not what I've read here. Once having formed the habit, I found I could not break. Yes. The last years, I knew when I drank, it led me back to crack cocaine. I don't want to drink anymore. I couldn't stay away from the first drink because the alcohol actually kept working at the end better than the drugs. It was short-lived because I'd lose control quickly and overshoot the mark. Okay, but I found that I formed a habit I couldn't break with alcohol, and I don't need to spend much time looking at my experience with crack cocaine. I lost my self-confidence. And so look into your experience leading into this current trip you've got through the steps. Did you lose your self-confidence? Did your reliance upon the people in your lives and all human powers, did you lose it? Or are there still human powers in your life that you think can solve your problem? And these problems, did they pile up and become astonishingly difficult to solve? So this paragraph here is important in to bring it inside of your experience. Not talking about a third person or the people that wrote this book. How is this for me? Is this true for me? So let's go into this next paragraph. We know what frothy emotional appeals is, and we know that it seldom suffices. The message that can interest us must have depth, experience, and weight, which is a solution. But here's the part that I want to talk about for a few minutes, and I'm going to wrap up this little portion here. But do you believe that if your ideals are grounded in a power greater than yourself, that you will recreate your life? This is a really important question. And then, and as you go further into the recovery process, the question for me today is, are my ideals grounded in a power greater than myself at home, at work, in my friendships, at my home group, in my interactions with the people that I see on a frequent basis? Because I'm struggling in some areas right now. And you know the reason why I'm struggling in these areas? It's because my ideals are not grounded in a power greater than myself. They're grounded, most of the time, they're grounded in my sound, what I believe is my sound reasoning, what I believe is my logic. That's typically what I'm worshiping in those areas, and I'm struggling. And I end up finding myself in constant collision with the people in those areas. It's simple. It's not complicated. No God, Tarek struggles. It's that simple. Tarek drinks and smokes crack essentially because he likes the effect produced by it, short-lived as it is. That sensation is so hard to find and get to, and I'll admit all day long that it hurts me, it's injurious. I'd reached the point where I couldn't tell the difference between the truth and the false. I couldn't tell the difference between what alcohol was doing for me near the end and what it was doing to me. It was giving me the anesthetic I required in order to deal with life and people, but at the same time, I would enter the loss of control phase so quickly, and once I've entered loss of control phase with alcohol, I'm going straight to cocaine. I must have cocaine. And so I was in this vicious cycle of thinking I could control my drinking, I'd lose control of my drinking, and I'm going to cocaine. So, I did this long enough to the point when I got into recovery, the idea of living a lifestyle that didn't surround itself around partying scared the hell out of me. Because I lived a life of 17 years of drugs and alcohol. 1995, I get into the Grateful Dead and widespread panic. So it's immediately high levels, high consumption of mind-altering substances. And then I get into selling drugs around 1997, 98, 99 in that area. And now that becomes a culture. That becomes a way of life. It's my identity. I have a whole persona built up around these things. And they're stripped. And I'm scared as hell. It's the only life I have ever known, really, in my manhood. Or childhood, probably, even though I was over 18. So Tarek exists in this place of being uneasy, easily annoyed, and never satisfied. Restless, irritable, and discontent. Unless Tarek can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a couple of Red Bull vodkas, a Xanax or a Valium, and smoking a few bowls, that's what really gave me ease and comfort. Right? But they all would set me, they sent me down this path that always ended with cocaine. right? Tyrone, right? You watch the Chappelle Show? Back in those days, he was like my idol, right? Find the biggest crack rock I could find. That was everything to me. It was my everything. I built a life surrounded and based on smoking crack cocaine. And believe it or not, I had friends who smoked crack with impunity. I remember I heard someone at a meeting one time say, everyone that smokes crack is an addict. Bullshit.
If that's the case, then everybody who ever has a sip of alcohol, they're an alcoholic. My 13-year-old son just went up to his grandfather's hunting camp up in the Poconos, Pennsylvania. I'm convinced that he had a beer. My son is not an alcoholic because he had a beer. Therefore, that logic must be flawed.
Yes, very flawed. But here's the story I'd like to share with you because it illustrates the loss of control and it illustrates why the effect produced in me is quite different than other people. So, we get to this bar, we're slamming drinks, we had Valium, and we overshoot the mark like we typically do, right? And so we pull our money together, we can't find any powder cocaine, and so I convince my two buddies, who I have smoked crack with before, let's pull our money together, I'll go downtown, I'll get us a bunch of slabs, we'll go back to my house. That's exactly what we did. Went and got $300 worth of crack, went back to my house. We're listening to music, we're smoking, and they're smoking and I'm smoking, but the only thing that exists for me is the crack on the coffee table, where they're able to converse and they're able to socialize and they're able to listen to music and put new music records on and whatever they're doing. I'm just smoking crack. The effect produced in me was quite different than the effect produced in them. The crack is gone, right? I can't remember. It's 3, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning maybe, still dark out. And I'm pacing around the house slamming Jim Beam because I need to calm down so I can get back in the car and go back downtown. So I'm trying to convince them to give me more money so I can drive downtown. And they said no. They said, we're going to sit here and chill and puff some bowls and drink, eat a couple of Valium, and just chill. I got in my car and went back downtown, and I stayed downtown for a couple of days. I watched them smoke crack with impunity. They didn't go blow the money I did. They didn't end up in the seedy places I did. But my mind continued to tell me that one day I would have that effect. I'd be a recreational crack smoker. They did it. Why can't I? And I followed that idea to the gates of insanity and almost death. After I succumbed to that desire again, and I'd pass through the well-known stages of a run, I'd be sitting in a hotel room, and I'd emerge remorseful after I've unplugged all the appliances, I'm making sure the voices in the air vents are gone now, and there's no one that's coming into my hotel room. I look in the mirror, and this little tear comes out of my eye, and I look at myself, and I say, you're a fucking piece of shit. And you're going to smoke crack for the rest of your life. And I'd make that firm resolution to myself. I'd say, I'm not fucking doing this anymore. Break all my stems, man. Finally wash my hands. And take a shower because I've been sweating through clothes for like 3 days straight, smelling like shit. I'm done. I'm never doing this again. Get back to my house. Probably left the hotel room maybe 7, 8 in the morning. My house started to feel a little bit better that night. Buddy comes over maybe. Hey, you want to smoke a bowl? You want to pop a couple of Valium? The next thing you know, I've forgotten that whole experience. And I'm off to the races again. So unless something happens to break my unconscious mind around this stuff, because there's an aspect of addiction that's conscious and there's an aspect to it that's unconscious. Something has to come in and alter that. It has to be changed. And that's what the 12 steps do. They grant you the capacity to access whatever it is that alters that, that breaks it for us. And so this is the conversations I have around this point in the book. And it's important that unless there is a psychic change, very little hope of my recovery. So ask the question. You're taking someone through the steps. What other solutions do you have? Because I invite you to try them all.
Girl, money, job,
Go try.
With my kids.
Okay, one last thing. I'm going to turn it over to Brandon. If you're sitting down and engaging someone about the physical craving, the physical powerlessness that's part of addiction, this is the best way to identify it. It's the easiest and the quickest way, and it talks about it on the bottom of page XXIX. It says, I do not hold with those who believe addiction or alcoholism are entirely problems of mental control. I've had many men or women who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, or they picked up some drugs. They developed a phenomenon of craving. It became paramount to all other interests, and so the important engagement was not met. These men and women were not drinking and using to escape. They were drinking and using to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And so I started asking questions like, okay, let's look at some family functions you were supposed to be at, and you picked up a drink or a drug a day or so before, and you didn't show up. For me, an important engagement was getting to work. Between the years of 2004 and 2006, I had this job. I was an analyst. I had a corner office. I had a putting green in my office. I had arrived. I mean, it was a straight pimp job. I mean, they would pay for me to go fly and see this band that I love so much, Widespread Panic, because they were big on giving their employees time to get away. So you would get this little voucher, a travel voucher. I mean, this was a dream come true for me, right? Eventually, I lost that job. I was fired. But I mastered the art of staying up all night smoking crack, eating a Klonopin about 4 or 5 in the morning, getting to work after I take a shower, put Do Not Disturb on the phone, close the door to the office until I quit tweaking out. An important engagement for me was getting to work every day. That was my important engagement. And it was to get to work sober so I could do a good job and keep this dream job that I had found. I couldn't keep that important engagement. I would lose control. I'd pick up a drink, usually the happy hour the night before. The famous happy hour. That's where I find my loss of control. That's where I find the physical powerlessness. So when you're taking someone through the steps, that's it. Just look. Let's look at these important engagements you had, and we're just going to see what happens after you start drinking and or using, and what did you arrive there. An important engagement is arriving sober to Thanksgiving with the family. That was the important engagement. I get there and I'm visibly intoxicated after mom tells me not to get visibly intoxicated. That's another engagement. This is how you take someone through the steps. It's a simple exercise. That's how you find physical powerlessness. So that's all we're going to cover in the doctor's opinion. That's how we use the doctor's opinion to identify physical powerlessness over drugs and or alcohol. I'm going to turn it over to Brandon.
Should I... I was going to maybe hit some recreate our lives, or should I dive into bills?
Recreate our lives.
Okay. Read that.
Okay. You guys that are in recovery here for an initial time or back for a first time, you have an opportunity. So I have this reading. It's one of my favorite out of 365 Dow. It's called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of oppression and adversity like addiction cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great difficulty, a tiny opportunity will open, if only by chance. You must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, and determined enough to do something about it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like a shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like the bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss. If you're always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it is easy to seize it. When you act, however, you in turn must have no shadow. In other words, what you do must have no messiness, no leftover consequences, nothing that will haunt you later. This is your opportunity. That is the one of the ways in which you avoid creating more bad situation for yourself and those who care about you. Your every movement through this process must be traceless.
So, an alcoholic, my name's Brandon. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. From your sponsor, from your parents, from all those people. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholics or addicts must have depth, like Tarek talked about, which is experience, and weight, which is current power. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So, a lot of the time when I get to this part in the doctor's opinion, what I try to hammer on is the fact that my life today does not in any way resemble my former life. It talks about our thought life when we get up into the 10th step. We get to co-create with this power. We get to use our willpower along these lines all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. We give our will away in the third step. We get it back in the 10th, and we get to co-create with this power. So at this point, I like to kind of try to pull in kind of, do you believe that you can actually recreate your life? Because I don't know that I had any belief in that whatsoever. The Big Book talks about it over and over again. And just because I like to go and verify from other sources, I've got this other book over here that was published in 1934 that says, all day long, the thoughts that occupy your mind, your secret place, are molding your destiny for good or evil. In fact, the truth is, the whole of one's life experience is but an outer expression of inner thought. It goes on further back in the book. It says, if your prayers are not being answered, search your consciousness and see if there is someone whom you have yet to forgive. So it's kind of pulling some of the steps back in. I got this other book that was taken from parts of this other author's writing from 1908 on to like 1930. That says, I stand at the mountaintop of my soul and cause my spiritual vision to encompass more. For as he thinketh in his heart, so he is. As far as his mind extends, so far extends heaven. My soul hath built for me a habitation. Another book written in late 1800s. A man is literally what he thinks his character being, the complete sum of his thoughts. Man is made or unmade by himself in the armory that he forges, the weapons by which he destroys himself and fashions the tools with which he builds for himself heavenly mansions of joy and strength and peace. And then this really disturbing sentence back here. Well, I'm going to hit another one. Men do not attract that which they want, but that which they are. Circumstance does not make the man, it reveals it to himself. If you're struggling in relationships, you are creating that. It's not until you clean up your life. It's not until you go through a cleansing process. It's not until you have a psychic change. It's not until you have a different vantage point on life do you actually gain access to the power that allows you to recreate your life. Man literally becomes what he thinks about all day long. I had a lot of trouble with that when I first got sober because I heard it and I thought about it and I'm like, that's not true. I didn't choose to become an alcoholic. My thoughts did not make me an alcoholic. I drank because I enjoyed it. I drank because I liked to clear my mind. Oh, what happened? I didn't think anymore. I thought about nothing. That was the purpose of me drinking, was to clear my mind and have no thoughts. What did I become as a result of my drinking? Nothing. I destroyed everything that was important to me. Wife, family, house, relationships, job. I have the power to change that for the good. I get to recreate my life in the fashion that I want. I get to have an abundant life. I love to talk about this when we get to this part of the doctor's opinion, because it's a lot of information. But we need to draw people into our experience with the hope that their experience can improve. We can't just sit there and pound them on their negative experience. We have to have them have some hope to turn their lives around and become something else. Luckily, we have a program that allows us to do that in a very short period of time. The magic that I have seen in the lives of men in weeks, months, I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen it have to take years. It's usually a couple months. And I don't know when it happens. Sometimes it happens at 3, sometimes it happens at 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11. At some point, this man shows up across from me and he is no longer the same man. He is not the same person. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. The men that are brought to us are broken. There's a promise in the paragraph right before that. He says, 1 year later, he called to me to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features. But there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and self-contentment. I talked with him some more, but I was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger. And so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. This book is full of promises. This book is full of opportunities for us to experience life in a different way. But we have to go through with the process. We can't just hope. We can't just wish. We actually have to do something. So I hope that, you know, over the course of this weekend, we can perk your attention to the fact that life may be we agnostics, it says, are you even willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? The question, I like to change that to, do you believe that there's a power greater than yourself that loves you more than you can possibly imagine, that can help you with anything that you're struggling with in your life, can take you beyond where you currently are in your experience, to take you beyond the greatest moment of life that you've ever had to something greater? Because that's what's here. The miracle to go forward and live not just the best life you can live, but the life better than what you could have ever possibly ever imagined. I can say that today because I've got it. I can say that today because I had a very interesting morning going to doctor's appointment with my wife, who was struggling with some physical ailments, and her struggling through that, and me talking to other people in my network, and they're struggling. And the statement we said is, isn't it interesting how you can have all this going on in life? Whoever would possibly ever get bored by life is just insane, because there's so much here. There's so much exciting stuff going on in the lives of all of us. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but it's here every single day. Do you want a little bit of it? Mark Houston always says, how much you want, You go to the ocean with a thimble. How much are you going to get? Thimble full of water. Mm. That's not what I want. I want to take the biggest truck I can, go fill it up, bring it home with me, fill a lake, go back and get more. Go back and get more. Go back and get more. Because where you can go with this stuff is the depths of our experience on this planet. They're greater than anything you could possibly imagine. Why wouldn't you want to try a little bit harder to go get more of it?
Hmm. Can I say something?
Yeah.
So Brandon and I today, we shared our struggles with each other, which I think is vital for permanent recovery. The longer I stay clean and sober, the more important and the more value that I place on this. And it's interesting what he was just describing. Him talking to me broke my identification with my mind. And we were able to observe the situations that we were in as if almost like they were happening to someone else and we could laugh about it. How limited I am as a human being. And I made the comment to him, this existence is so interesting. The way I show up with so many limitations, and I experienced them head on today, my limitations. But by talking to him, I'm not identified with it. I've moved on from it. But what happens to a lot of people, they don't get that grace. They want to stay within themselves, and they want to think that a solitary self-appraisal is sufficient. It's not. You have to talk to someone and compare notes, which breaks you from identification with your mind as if it's the only reality out there. It's not. It's not.
I can't tell you how many times I was struggling with something little in the morning, and I get a call from Tarek or somebody else, and they're telling me something big that they're struggling with. And I share the little struggle I had with this morning, and they sit there and go, "Oh, it's the same thing." The universe consistently puts people into my life that are struggling with the exact same thing I'm struggling with and showing me it from a different perspective so that my terminal uniqueness is broken and I actually realize everybody else struggles with stuff too. Strange.
Is that a good stopping place?
I think so.
All right, we're going to take a 15-minute break followed by our speaker meeting.